Radio.
What's the issue with same-sex marriage? A panel discussion with James Parker, Monica Dumit, and Father Daniel McCann at Catholic Youth Services Catholicism 101.
Well, good evening and welcome to what's really one of the most probably important Catholicism 101 topics so far. 2015's been a big year in the debate over same-sex marriage. In May, the people of Ireland, you might recall, voted to legalise same-sex marriage in their country. In June, the American Congress took what was an unprecedented step of declaring same-sex marriage legal in all its states. In Australia, legislation's been tried in Parliament on numerous occasions, but failed each time. And the current Liberal government recently has promised there'll be a plebiscite or a general vote on the issue after the 2016 election. If you ever watch Q&A or you read anything in the mainstream media, you know that there's only one right way forward now, and that is same-sex marriage. The occasional voice does make it through, I guess, such mediums, to make the point that this unbridled push towards same-sex marriage and changing the fundamental meaning of what this institution is not something to be taken lightly. And I guess through all this debate that's gone on back and forth, the Catholic Church continues to proclaim this particular vision for marriage and the family. The Australian bishops recently expressed this vision in a beautiful, perhaps unfortunately named letter, titled Don't Mess With Marriage. And I encourage you to Google it if you haven't read it. It doesn't take long to read, but it's really worthwhile. Same-sex marriage, it's a complex, a multifaceted issue. And we all feel the pull to support and equally love all our brothers and sisters. But what does that look like in practice? How are we to respond to and to reason through the issue? No matter where you sit or how you feel, you're very welcome here tonight. We've assembled what we believe, what we hope, is a strong panel to look at this issue from three different perspectives, three different angles. And we hope that we'll all leave tonight with much, much food for thought. So let us begin with our first speaker, who is James Parker. And I'll just pull up his introduction. James just arrived last night from Perth, so we're very happy that he's come over to join us. And he's got a great bio, so I'm going to share it with you. Just some of it. So James worked for 3 years in the field of sports management, and he worked with a lot of high-profile sports athletes. During that time, he converted to Catholicism. He then transferred his career and his work to the Vatican, where he directed the organisation and the management of a number of international events, mostly across Africa, but in Europe and the Middle East. After that, he entered working for the Cardinal Archbishop of Westminster. In practice, what he was doing was advising on public policy, and he has an extensive knowledge of dealing with the press and diplomatic relations. James is a founding member of the International Catholic Network for Men called Harvesters, under whose umbrella he's travelled across Europe and Africa, bringing the gospel message to thousands of men. For 10 years, James also facilitated the UK's Southern Chapter of Courage, which is part of a global Catholic apostolate, which serves to support men and women with same-sex attraction, leading them more deeply into Christ and to the teachings of the Catholic Church. James also been employed by the bishops of England and Wales as their representative, working alongside the 2012 Olympic and Paralympic Games. And until several months ago, he was working here in Australia, in Perth, as the communications director for the Archdiocese of Perth. In recent years, and he'll probably enlighten you in more of his story, he's shared openly about his life as a gay rights activist and then his subsequent conversion to Christ. He's taught extensively on same-sex marriage, on childhood sexual abuse, sexual addiction. He's run programs and seminars across Europe to help foster new groups and organizations to help support men and women in their journey towards recovery. He remains passionate about the dignity and the godly restoration of men and women. James lives in Perth, as I mentioned. He's married, he has one daughter, and we're very happy he's with us. And so I'm going to leave him now to the microphone and thank James for being with us.
Thank you very much. I think they've put me on first tonight because I'm so shy. That's the only thing I don't want you to believe that I tell you tonight, okay? Did I fit all that in my lifetime? I don't know how I fitted all that in, but there we are. Hey ho. So listen, it's really, really lovely to be here with all of you tonight. I hope my eyesight can see that screen down there. Yeah, I was a gay rights activist in London. I was raised very anti-Catholic. Those weird Catholic people who thought funny things, you know. I threw myself very much heart and soul into the gay community and the gay scene when I went to study in London at the age of 18. I ended up being put into a Catholic college in the university where I was at in London. And of course, I didn't like these Catholics there. Anyway, so I set up the lesbian and gay group there, and me and my mates used to try and get the condom machine put inside the gents' toilets, and security would rip it out, and then we'd go and get the condom machine put in again, and security would rip it out, etc. And, you know, that was my attitude, really. And very short and sweet, because it would be several volumes of a book, I ended up being wooed into the Catholic Church. And I was wooed into the Catholic Church when I was living in my long-term gay relationship. That I have to be honest with you, I did pray to God with a very, very clear tick list of what I wanted in Mr. Right. And those prayers were answered. I'm not saying God answered the prayers. All I know is all those boxes were ticked. I'm not saying that God was sending me the perfect boyfriend. But I met an amazing, amazing man whom I deeply, deeply loved, and we were faithful to each other. Not just that, but in the midst of that relationship, people say, you know, oh, are you practicing homosexuals? We say, no, we've perfected it. In the midst of that relationship with my ex Steve, I was being wooed into the church, and I was being wooed into a relationship with the person of Jesus Christ. So much so that as I went on that journey, Steve saw the difference in me. And he went, wow, you're kind of lighter and happier. You don't seem as anxious as you used to be. And let me tell you, I bounce off the walls now. And I was much more bouncing off the walls then. So he realized I was much calmer. And he said, is it this sort of prayer gathering thing you go to with these young people? And I said, yeah. He said, can I come along too? I said, of course you can. So Steve came along and he was deeply touched by the Lord's love, really deeply touched. The two of us were. We began to pray daily. We began to read our Bibles. Steve was a lapsed Catholic. I wasn't a Catholic, so he started going back to Mass, and I was following him going to Mass and all the rest of it. And again, I was still being wooed in and pulled into the church, etc. And we became the archetypal Christian gay couple. And we were going around all these straight dinner parties. Oh, we've got this lovely Christian gay couple coming, you know, and Steve and I'd walk in. I just ought to tell you, I was wearing makeup in those days. I'm very serious, and my voice was a lot higher, and my walk was very, very camp, and Steve was the kind of, we used to say he was the butch, I was the bitch, forgive the phrase, but that's what we used to say. That was our vocabulary, you know, and I'd walk in, hi, etc., you know, and I don't mean that mockingly, that's just where I was, until Christ got a hold of me, and then it was a number of months later that the Lord began to really to speak to me in my prayer. The deeper I went in prayer, the more time I spent before Jesus in the Blessed Sacrament, and the more that these Catholic friends I was hanging around with but didn't tell my parents about, the more I began to enter into the depth of Catholic spirituality, but I got just drawn into the heart of Jesus. And I began to find rituals around my life that I needed to give me some sense of boundaries, something concrete, to be able to help me to understand what was going on in my life. To the point that in my own prayer, I hit a point about 6 or 7 months later, after Steve and I had been deeply touched by the Holy Spirit and reading our Bibles, etc., I felt the Lord was saying to me one day, you must finish this relationship. I agonized over it. It's the best thing I'd had. A Catholic priest had said to me, don't leave him. He's the best thing you'll ever have. My Anglican priest said to me, because I was an Anglican at the time, he said, don't leave Steve. He's the best thing you've got. But I knew in my heart, God was saying, you must finish this relationship. And I did. But I had a community to step into of believers. So I didn't just cut off from Steve. I cut off from the gay scene. I cut off from gay activism, and I decided I can no longer wear this label gay over me. Now, that doesn't mean to say I didn't have to. I wasn't trying to deny the urges and the desires and these same-sex attractions. I was exclusively homosexual. There was not an ounce in me that really saw women or noticed women or thought them beautiful. I was just man-hungry. It's where I was at. But it was there that I began to dialogue with the Lord, and I learned to begin to listen to him in my prayer. And slowly but surely, the Lord began to reveal many things to me. The first thing he revealed to me, which was critical, and I'm talking over several years here, a lot of prayer and therapy, but he showed me I'd been sexually abused, and horrendously so, and for quite a time as a child. He also showed me that as an adoptee, which I am, and I have a twin sister, that actually we'd both, in a sense, even from birth, we'd cut off from parents. We'd felt so deeply abandoned and wounded, even as small infants, that really we'd both built these walls around our lives just to protect ourselves. And our personalities were becoming much, much more intertwined with each other. So I was the kind of the camp guy. And she was, you know, a beautiful woman, but she was, you know, she'd like, don't touch my brother, bang. And she'd hit the boys, you see, you know, and I'd go, you see. And really, we'd swapped each other's identities. Now, the world would say, well, that's who James is, and that's who his twin is, etc. But God said something different. And he began to touch me, and he began slowly, through the Holy Spirit, who teaches us all things, Jesus says to us, began to unravel the things in my life. Began to unravel them. And he began to apply his healing touch into the very areas that he was bringing up in my prayer. To the point that, you know, as I began to take my place as a man among other men, having cut off from the gay community, when I found resolution in the areas where I'd cut my own self off from the true masculine, but through prayer, Jesus was leading me to my forever daddy. So I was able to be healed in that area of my relationship with my father. And then he led me, he said, James, my mother's your mother. And I began to trust our forever mummy. And what happened is the real, the true James began to come up, rise up. My voice began to drop, my walk began to change. And what happened is, suddenly, not only did I feel that I could stand alongside other men as equals, I began to notice something called woman. Really notice woman, wow. So I thought, now I understand, Adam, why you went, whoa, yeah, flesh in my flesh, bone in my bone. Wow, that's pretty good, Lord, whoa. The pinnacle of creation. You know, that had been a foreign thing to me. I'm not even starting my talk. God, what am I? Anyway, I told you I could go on a little bit. But in a sense, that's part of the background, what I want to share with you. And say for 10 years, as Bernard mentioned, I've walked with literally hundreds of men and women. I've not just walked with them. I've walked with them when they've been spewed out of the gay community, feeling absolutely traumatized and used. I walk with those who don't want anything to do with the gay community and have never self-identified really as gay, but they've got same-sex attraction. They struggle, and they've got nowhere else to go with it. I've dealt with the married men and the married women, and all the different people with all these different aspects. You know, the issue is this. We've all got broken sexuality. And until we realize, which is actually the last point I'm making today, but I might as well say at the beginning, you'll hear it twice that way. But until we get to grips with the fact that we are all on this journey together, it's not an us and them journey, will real healing begin to take place in our society, and we may be able to elevate and honor marriage what it really is. Okay, let's get on with this. Let me take just a few differences in my own experiences between what it's like living in a same-sex attracted relationship compared to another sex attracted relationship. These aren't all the points, but just a few for you to become aware of. You know, when a person breaks their wedding vows, there is incredible pain in a marriage, incredible pain, and rightly so. Because there is something, a part of heaven has suddenly been broken or tarnished, etc. In a same-sex attracted relationship, monogamy is about what's emotional. I could come through to a few statistics for you, but actually we'll come to those in a minute, actually. There are some, there's a number of different research projects out there that show, for example, that 94% of married people and 75% of cohabiting people have had only one partner in the last year. Thanks be to God, because in a sense they're committed to each other. But in the gay community, there is monogamy, but without fidelity. Of gay men, 66% had had sex outside of their relationship in that first year. That number rises to around 90% if the relationship lasts 5 years or more. You won't be aware of that because you don't hear those figures. That is common practice in the gay community. It's common practice. People share each other, couple looking for a third person to join in and the rest of it. Gay and lesbian relationships are generally very short-lived. For couples who, actually only 15% of gay men end up generally with a relationship that lasts for more than 3 years. It's a bit higher for lesbian relationships, about 17.3%. This is from gay research from within the gay community. This isn't something that's been done by the straight community. I don't like the word gay and straight, but I think you know I'm coming from in the midst of those. In the very late part of the 20th century, there was a very far-ranging study of homosexual men revealed that 75% of white men who self-identified as gay, 75% of them admitted to having had more than 100 different partners in their lifetime. 15% of those claim to have had between 100 and 249 sexual partners. 17% of those claim to have had 250 to nearly 500 partners. And 15% claimed 500 to nearly 1,000. And 28% claimed more than 1,000 lifetime male sexual partners. Now, those figures have since risen. I say with honesty to you, and with no pride whatsoever, I had over 200 gay lovers. And some of my friends laugh at me. They think I was almost virginal because that's all I'd had. But you end up awash in this world of eroticism and sex, generally. The issue, the difference is this, is anything, the expression of that which is of eros, healthy, redeeming eros within an other sex relationship, within a marriage, is something that's very, very sacred and it's done in private. Within the gay community, the LGBTQI community generally, it's something that's very, very public. It's not unusual to go to a gay friend's house and say look, where's your porn collection? Oh, let me show you what I've got and what I've downloaded, etc. It's more common than ever, of course, because pornography is so very, very accessible. So there's a very, very different, there's a opposite ends of the scale. You know, guys and women, many women today struggle with pornography. Many guys struggle with pornography. We keep it hidden. We keep it secret. In the gay community, it's celebrated to some greater or lesser extent. The other thing is this is within marriage. My marriage calls me to be other-centered. It calls me to die to myself. Whereas a same-sex relationship generally is self-centered. Now, that none of this is in any way, shape, or form meant to be condemnatory. This is more the insights of what's going on. The issue for the gay man, deep down, is that he's never, ever deeply attached to his own kind. So men are still a mystery to him. So he goes in search of that the deep connection with other men that's a mystery. Well, the only other man that will engage with him is a gay man. Because, I mean, straight guys will be his friends, but he's not going to go around doing stuff with him, you know, sexy stuff. So what happens is you've got two gay men looking for the same thing from each other, and neither of them's got it. So they're looking to take from here and take from there. It all becomes about filling that void that's never quite been met deep, deep, deep within me. So you end up being incredibly self-centered. The challenge is this. The guys you find most attractive are the straight guys. You can't have them. So you have all you get is the gay guys to some extent. So you end up with this insatiable search for mystery, but you're never satisfied. The beautiful thing about marriage is the masculine and the feminine, the male and the female come together. And yes, we never understand you ladies, and that's a good thing. And you never understand us, and that is a hard thing. But let's be honest, you know. Anyway, long and short of it is that, you know, there's mystery, but that mystery is satiated in the midst of the relationship between a man and woman in that covenant of relationship that we call marriage. I've got that the wrong way around. Other sex attracted people don't glory in shame. It's the other way around. We feel shame if we're not living our true glory before God. But in the gay community, it's almost like, you know, you sort of rejoice in the shameful things, you know. Almost how pervy can you get? What fetishes are you into? And all this type of vocabulary that you never hear unless you've been right there at the heart of that community. And look, this isn't everybody who is same-sex attracted. I'm talking about life in the gay community and what's happening in the lives of many of the gay activists who are trying to promote same-sex marriage today. Other sex-attracted people, there's a softening of the extremes. In other words, where guys are very visual and kind of, you know, everything becomes visual and kind of just 2D, women bring in that sense of, well, there could be another option, and they bring in more of a sense of 3D, and the softening of women. Women can soften men, but then also men soften women. When women end up in their deep emotional world and, oh, my God, and all my feelings, etc., and they go, darling, calm down. We have to make a decision. Now, I mean, this is broad brush statements, but your laughter means you know what I'm talking about here. Thanks be to God. Hey, yeah, that's it. But there's a softening of the extremes. The issue comes in a same-sex relationship when it's committed to each other is often for the two women, it's a very It's a very difficult, often and painful thing to watch, but when two lesbian women are really trying to find each other from each other, and neither of them have what they need to be able to find each other, it can become a massive emotional roller coaster. But then when two gay men get together, there's a sense in which they're both together, they're both going, oh, look at him, no, look at him, oh, look at him, but look at him. There's a sense in which they miss each other. And so what happens is there's a constant sense of anxiety that's riddled deep down underneath. For the other sex-attracted couples, there are very, very few medical issues. Sorry to get biological with you, but the vagina has 27 layers of muscle to it. It can take penetration and friction and childbirth. It has a natural lubrication to it. Everything about it is beautifully designed. It has an immunosuppressive reaction, whatever it is, to semen and to sperm. In a sense, the vagina is like trying to punch a piece of rubber. You know, the rubber doesn't get affected. The anal passage is one thin layer of tissue. It's like taking your hand with a piece of glad wrap and going bang, it just goes straight through. Which means all the bodily fluids and all the stuff up there from that toxic place become mixed up and the rest of it. There are loads more medical issues in the gay community than there ever are. You know, there are pathogens that exist in the gay community that don't exist in the straight community. There are STDs that exist in the gay community that don't exist in the straight community. There's a guy called John Diggs, we'll quote him in a minute, amazing paper that looks at this. Numerous medical issues for the gay community. Still with me? Yeah, okay. Really quick, because I'm running out of time already. Five areas that John R. Diggs looks at. If you're concerned, I think this is massive in the argument around same-sex marriage. Because let's be honest, if I turn around and married Steve, which we'd been planning to do, then putting it bluntly, there'd have been some oral or some anal sex going on somewhere. The British Medical Association have come out in the last 2 years. They're not come out as gay, they've just come out and said. These phrases get stolen. Behave, James. Okay. Anyway, the British Medical Association have come out and they've said they've seen a massive rise in the last few years of oral and esophageal cancers and anal and bowel cancers, particularly among young people. Because what's happening, they're looking at pornography and they're experimenting. We're all told, go and try it. Go and give it a go. So this equal love that the gay community, and this hurts me, and it hurts me for them. They're saying it's equal love, but actually they're destroying each other's bodies. They're destroying each other's lives. And Diggs says, this is an amazing bit of research. That's why you never hear about it. But actually, the epidemiology results show that generally practicing homosexuals live 20 years less than other people. Now, if you're not on the gay scene, you don't go to the funerals. You don't see what's going on. There's a lot of important information there. Equal love versus real love. For the other sex-attracted person, as I said, there's that complementarity, that sense of having a soulmate. And what happens is we both become subjective. I'm about me and you're about you, and we walk together. We're alongside each other subjectively around this beautiful objective world that God's given us and the creation around us. For the same-sex attracted person, really deep down, what same-sex marriage is, which is a total oxymoron and is hoodwinking gay people to believing they can have something they cannot have. And I don't like the lies and the injustice that our legislation might just put through towards gay people like stupid Ireland and stupid Britain and stupid USA have done. They're basically lying to gay people saying you can have something you can't. It's not fair. It's an injustice. And God doesn't like that either. Okay? But basically, they're looking at trying to bless a primary emotional commitment. Now, we would call that a friendship. I've learned now, as I've gathered around me all these great male friends, I'm thinking, hang on a minute. What I experienced with you is ultimately what I was looking to experience with Steve, but ours was all eroticized. What I was trying to look for with all my other boyfriends. But now I've got all these mates around me. So what the same-sex marriage is, it's trying basically to bless an eroticized friendship is what it's doing. And if it was a monogamous one, that wouldn't be too bad. And if it was life-giving, that would maybe be a good thing. But it's not either. And what happens is in the midst of the same-sex attraction is you constantly feel like others are different to me. I don't feel quite normal. Why did it take so long for Ian Thorpe to come out and say, oh, I didn't think Australia was ready for its hero to be gay? We all accept him. Well done, Ian. Well done for being so honest with yourself. That was courageous. Ian found it hard to accept Ian because of the turmoil deep within him. That's the issue we've got to look at around same-sex attraction. Scott James, New York Times. Gay nuptials are portrayed by opponents as an effort to rewrite the traditional rules of matrimony. Quietly outside of the news media and courtroom spotlight, many gay couples are doing just that. With straight people, it's called affairs and cheating, said Hoff, who did this principal investigation that Scott James reported on. With gay people, it doesn't have to have such negative connotations. Whoa. None of this is news in the gay community, but few will speak publicly about it. Author Joe Quirk, It's Not You, It's Biology, said the traditional American marriage is in crisis. We need insight. If innovation in marriage is to occur, it will be spearheaded by homosexual marriages. Rapidly looking at history and strategy. The word homosexuality was first used in 1864. The way we talk about it, you think the Greeks had used it and everybody else had used it, the whole works. It first came into being in 1864. The gay rights movement was only really truly birthed in 1969, during my lifetime. Still very, very new. There is a deliberate homosexualization of history. Ignore my quotation marks, there's a double and a single there. A book written in 1989, and we were talking about this as gay activists in the late 80s before the book came out, but the book actually said it all, called After the Ball by a gay psychologist and marketeer. And the book After the Ball said, basically, if we want homosexuality to be seen to be normal, and we've got to do everything we can to do this, we have got to take in leader. We've got to infiltrate and take in leadership of the media, of education, of politics, of entertainment, and particularly of sport. The last bastion is sport. Sport's about men doing their sport, women doing their sport generally. They want to bring all that down. Bring it all down to the lowest common denominator. Then we're all okay, we're all equal, aren't we? Instead of actually facing, looking inside and saying, maybe there's something, there's a challenge I need to face within myself as a same-sex attracted person. It's all reverse psychology or transference. It's all outside of us. We've got to make sure everybody changes to become like us. This sounds really, really coarse, but I'm trying to say this from my experience and the experience of literally hundreds of people I've walked with. To some extent, we wanted to use reverse psychology for homosexuality to be seen to be superior to heterosexuality. We're going to look at Men's Health magazine very quickly in a moment. And to normalize all sexual expression, no clear boundaries, and to reject monogamy. That's the book After the Ball, How America Will Conquer Its Fear and Hatred of Gays in the 1990s. As I say, a psychologist, and in the medical profession, it's psychiatry and psychology that are trying to say there's nothing wrong, it's all fine. And yet I've been surrounded by people who are still depressed and drug abuse and suicidal. Hey, and those same issues are now in the heterosexual community for all sorts of similar reasons, but that's something for another time. The media has its own way of portraying things. I've worked with the media for nigh on 25 years, intimately with the BBC and the ABC and Fox and you name it, the whole lot. I know the media well. I love that picture because so often I can brief journos across the world on story and then I read it and think, I have no idea how you ended up at that. Oh, my sub-editor changed it. Oh, they changed, etc. And it becomes something different to what it is. It's not judging anybody. I'm just saying, beware of what you read in the media. The other thing is this, is the Catholic Church is working very, very hard to challenge the issue of childhood sexual abuse. I've been working at the heart of that for some time. Last year, Icon Mail, the gay porn organization, brought out one of their new films that was a major seller, Forgive Me, Father. Daddy priest having sex with lots and lots of young boys. What's happening is within the gay community, our rubbish is glorified. But they turn around and they poke a finger at they. I don't like the word they, but there are people within their community who turn around and all they want to do is to mock us and keep us quiet so that the normalization of all sexualities can take place. Please understand this is what's going on. Men's Health magazine, just an average Aussie Men's Health magazine this March. Wake up your sex life. The word sex has to be on the front of a man's magazine to make it sell, and by gum does it sell if the word is there. I wonder what this wake up your sex life is. Gay guys to the rescue. Same-sex couples are happier and more satisfied and have better sex than everyone else. Use their secrets to supercharge your own relationship, they say. Next couple of pages. See where the gay guys are? Some of the statistics as well. In the magazine, this was done by Australia's Men's Health magazine, 83% of gay men are grateful they don't have to deal with a straight woman. You laugh. That means there is pure misogyny. The worrying thing about this is you get a gay couple who decide we're going to have twins, a boy and a girl, and they hate the world of a straight woman and her emotional world. What are they going to do to that girl? Because they haven't dealt with their misogyny. They've got no idea how to even begin to basically help her to develop. These are very, very worrying things. And of course, that would be a result of having same-sex marriage. 23% report having sex 3 or 4 times a week. It doesn't say who they're having sex with. 49% think they'll adopt or have children someday. These are media, this is the world trying to make us think this is all fine and normal. I'm coming into land, I'm so sorry, but I knew you needed to hear this. What does the same-sex attracted person's heart really need? We all need somebody to look us in the eyes and give us their attention. To somebody to look at us and say, you're great. What a handsome guy you are. What a beautiful woman you are. And to embrace us. Skin is our biggest organ of all. The same-sex attracted person is desperate. Desperate. More than the other sex attracted person is. For somebody to actually stand alongside them and to love them. Just to love them. When all of us have those three things in our lives, those three A's, we have the big A, which is self-acceptance. Jesus needed it. We need it. They also need their own sex to be demystified, which means if you're a man, please, if you're an other sex-attracted man, please in some way go and befriend the heart of a same-sex-attracted guy. And the same is true for other sex-attracted women with same-sex-attracted women. I also want to say that I recognize, too, sexuality is incredibly fluid for many of us today. There's so many things hitting us. Some of us have no idea where on earth we are and where we're going. Total acceptance for the gay community. Remember, the gay community set themselves up as a community, and now it's become an us and them. What we need to do is to go back and say, there's no us and them. We're all together on this journey. We're all broken. We all need our sexuality to be redeemed. And the church has got to take a lead in this, which means that we've got to start getting vulnerable about where we struggle, guys, and some of you ladies, in your struggle with the pornography or masturbation or your fantasy life, etc. I stand here talking about these things. I'm so used to talking about these things in the company of others who've got used to talking about it. They don't have to be shameful things. If we're not careful, Satan will steal the love from us and that real rich relationship with Christ that we need. But we have to have safe and discreet places to do that. This isn't stuff to be thrown about in public, as some communities do. We need to get educated on human development. There are 4 types of love. I'm not going to go into them now. You can look it up. 4 kinds of loves. C.S. Lewis wrote a great book called The 4 Loves. I want to say this quick thing about same-sex attraction compared to the Catholic Church. And this is a bit blunt, but hopefully you'll get it. You know, what is it that makes one man want to penetrate another man in his rear passage? It's because the man being penetrated is saying, I need to consume something of you that I don't think I've got. I want to take you into me. I want your bodily fluid. If I've got part of your bodily fluid in me, then I might feel like I'm connected to you, etc. I know this is really coarse, but this is what's going on. This is what's happening right at the core, and nobody's talking about this. What happened for me is I began to realize that was a sign that I was hungry for the Eucharist. I was hungry for fluid deep within me to run within my veins, Christ's blood in my veins. I was hungry for my body to be connected to his body. I stand before you as a man today, loving being in my skin, loving being a man, loving this body, even though it's been raped numerous times before puberty, because of what Jesus, I have been brought into Jesus through the Eucharist. The Catholic Church has so many of the richest responses that we need to get out there with, not just to the gay community or the LGBTQIA to Z community, but to society as a whole. My last slide, I hope, then the others can talk. This is really important as an adoptee, as I mentioned at the beginning. The critical issues that I had around my sexuality was the fact that I wasn't raised. I'd had 7 months in the womb, because we were born 2 months premature, of hearing this heartbeat, boom, 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 boom. Then we were ripped away from it. Nothing. My sister and I had this deep, deep anxiety. My twin sister's not a committed Christian. I still see her living out of that anxiety. I'm a Christian. I don't have to live out of that anymore. What I'm trying to say to you is that if we permit same-sex marriage and we permit same-sex couples to be able to adopt children, you end up often with four parents involved. You end up with perhaps a gay couple and a lesbian couple trying to deal with kids. And what happens is their relationship becomes paramount more than the children's needs. But my issues were the fact that I was cut off from my first father and mother meant that I eventually grew with issues. I had issues. That's why I needed to discover my forever daddy and my forever mummy. Both mummy as in the mother church, as well as the role of Mother Mary, but also God as father. So if we accept same-sex marriage, we will be seeing a much higher and rapid rise of homosexuality in and around our midst. We just will. And I know that from much of the sex work and the men's work I've been doing. I've also noticed this, is that kids who are born of IVF, and we've got a lot more people in the UK born of IVF, it's very common now, but a number of them are in their mid, late 20s, and I've had the opportunity to pray with some of them, to really pray deeply into their anxiety one-to-one. And a number of them have lost a deep sense of well-being, because what happens is they didn't begin life there with their mother's heartbeat, and that wasn't a continuum for them. And they feel something's deeply, deeply missing within them. So there's signs already that when we start messing with natural law, there is a derogatory outcome for the people concerned. And what's happened is, and it's a week's lectures really, but for same-sex attracted people, we feel a sense of loss, or we felt a sense of loss already from the way in which we've been raised to some extent. We don't want to add a further loss to the next generation. I think that's it. There you go.
Thank you, James, for a very personal and reflective presentation. Thank you very much. I want to move on to our next panelist, who's Monica Duman. And Monica has degrees in law and bioethics. Previously to her current position, Monica worked as a senior legal counsel for Challenger Limited, a legal firm, both here and overseas. And since the beginning of 2014, she's been the coordinator of Catholic Talk. Catholic Talk is a group of lay and religious people who seek to share their faith across traditional and social media, and really trying to take the conversation out to where it's happening. So Monica is going to bring her sharp mind, her preparation to the legal ramifications of same-sex marriage. Thanks, Monica.
Good evening. So I'm going to hit the legal aspects and the human rights aspects of the same-sex marriage debate tonight. As Bernard mentioned, we're looking at a plebiscite, but we also know that nothing is certain in federal politics. But it looks like we have about 12 months or so before a public vote on the redefinition of marriage is held. And as Catholics, we need to be able to have this conversation with other people and with the public. So that's why evenings like tonight are crucially important. Thank you so much to CYS for putting this on and inviting us here. So in Australian law at the moment, marriage is defined as the union of a man and a woman to the exclusion of all others, voluntarily entered into for life. What this tells us is that marriage has four main components. It's heterosexual because it's the union of a man and a woman. It's monogamous because it's to the exclusion of all others. It's a free choice and it's permanent. And what I'm going to propose to you is that the reason that this definition exists and the reason that we have marriage laws at all is because of the link between marriage and children. And until recently, this wouldn't have sounded like a crazy idea, let alone a horrid, prejudicial and backward one. It was understood and accepted that marriage was the only appropriate place for sex and procreation for a long time, and it's only come to be challenged with the widespread acceptance of premarital sex, contraception and assisted reproduction. And all of these are relatively new, say in the last 50 years or so. Even now, culturally, we still see a link between marriage and children. While 80% of couples live together before they get married, more than two-thirds of children are still born within marriage. So even if we don't see marriage as the only place where children are raised, we still consider it culturally as the primary place for them to be raised. And also, anyone that comes from a family like mine know as soon as you get married, the questions start, when are you going to have children? When are you going to have children? Doesn't happen to people who are living together. And the link to children helps us to understand the other components of the definition of marriage. Children are the reason that marriage is designed or legalised as monogamous and permanent. If marriage and children weren't fundamentally linked, and if sex was just a recreational activity, then there would be no reason for our law to say that marriages should be restricted to two people or that they should last forever. The presence of children and the importance of stability for them is why we have laws around monogamy and permanency in the first place. And the link between marriage and children tells us why governments get involved with marriage at all. The government doesn't make laws about friendship or any other type of personal relationship. Governments get involved in marriage because stable families benefit society as a whole. Marriage binds a mother and father to each other and also to any children that they might have. And children perform better in a stable home environment in any number of factors: education, employment, mental health, their own relationship stability, teen pregnancy and more. Without stable families, the government would need to spend more on law enforcement and on health, on welfare and on social services. Laws about marriage are not about providing public recognition of romantic relationships. The reason the government gets involved, the reason we have marriage law, is because marriage makes economic sense. I'm sorry to burst the bubble of any hopeless romantics in the room, but that's why we have laws about marriage. Those who are asking for the definition of marriage to be changed, as James was talking about, are seeking to prioritise the emotional relationship of the adults over anything to do with children. But if we change the marriage law in a way that does away with the very reason for its existence in the first place, then we can expect there'll be resultant changes in our social fabric. Laws shape culture. Once we have a law that says that something is legally permitted, the cultural shift occurs where we consider it to be morally acceptable and then completely normal. Let's take a look at one of the other pillars for a moment, the idea of marriage being for life and the introduction of no-fault divorce. We're coming up to 40 years of legalised no-fault divorce in this country. 40 years ago, there needed to be a reason for divorce to occur. You needed to prove adultery, alcohol or drug abuse, insanity, cruelty, or some other reason of blame in order for you to be allowed a divorce at law. The introduction of no-fault divorce had really, really good intentions. It took away the blame game and the finger-pointing when a marriage was breaking down. It reduced the hostility of any divorce proceedings, which was a net positive for any children involved. It also meant that if somebody was being abused, they didn't have to prove that in court. It made it easier for them to get out. In the reforms of the divorce law, and when they were considering that, nobody was intending to destroy marriage or to tear away at it. But in 40 years, what's that, two generations, we can see what a change in law has done to the culture. Not immediately, but in a generation or two, it absolutely changed our idea of what marriage is. Today, more than a third of all marriages end in divorce. Because once no-fault divorce became legal, divorce became morally acceptable and then somewhat normal. We used to be shocked or at least saddened by divorce. Now you can buy divorce cards right next to the marriage cards in the news agencies. People throw divorce parties. Some people don't even take the as long as we both shall live vows, but something smaller like as long as we both shall love. So even without the same-sex marriage debate, society is already at a point where we are prioritising the emotional relationship of the adults over the requirement of stability for children. So what no-fault divorce has shown us just in 40 years is that changing marriage law to remove or amend one of the key elements does have ramifications for the whole of society and how generations to come will understand marriage. So when it comes to redefining marriage, the conversation isn't about whether or not a change in law will change the culture. Of course it will. We know it will. The conversation is about whether or not this will be a positive or a negative thing. So let's look at that in particular. The first thing I would like to say about it is that the redefinition of marriage would undermine the idea that marriage is linked to children. Sure, gay couples can and do adopt or use the various reproductive technologies to have children, but marriage itself would not be about children. They would become an optional extra. Over a generation or two, in the same sort of 40 years that we've seen with divorce, we'd come to accept that marriage exists primarily to serve the emotional and physical needs of the adults and not to create a stable environment for the children. the adults would be the main focus. On the flip side of that, there's also the likelihood that the redefinition of marriage will increase the use of assisted reproductive technologies. If marriage is redefined, we'll see an increase of use of IVF, commercial surrogacy overseas, as well as increased pressure to legalise commercial surrogacy here. I won't go into all of the problems with those types of assisted reproductive technologies, but you all would have heard things like the baby gammy case and the exploitation of women overseas. It will not be better if surrogacy is legalised here. We can pick that up in the Q&A if anyone's really keen. The next thing that it would do is it would promote the idea that there is really no difference between the genders when it came to parenting and that mothers and fathers are interchangeable. But the best evidence that we have tells us that mothers and fathers contribute different things to a child's flourishing, and this affects them right through their life. Mothers are exclusively influential in the areas of things like study, work, and financial success. Fathers influence general life enjoyment, coping mechanisms, and mental health. The idea that marriage can exist between people of the same gender would create an institution where children will intentionally be deprived of a close relationship with mum or dad to the detriment of some of these key factors of human flourishing. All of these three have something in common, because what they're doing is they're prioritising the emotional desires of the adults over the children and to their detriment. As Catholics, this is an issue for us because we're called to have a preferential option for the poor and vulnerable, including children. But matters of faith aside, all of the major human rights instruments tell us that when we're making laws about children or which affect children, that the best interest of the child should be paramount in decisions which involve them. So it's human rights law which comes into play here as well. The next thing I want to say, and this is just a brief point, but the logical conclusion of redefining marriage to make a public declaration of love as the most important factor is that we can expand marriage to include other relationships. If marriage is only about love and celebrating commitment, there's no need to limit marriage to two people if love is the only key ingredient. And finally, we need to be aware of the potential threat to religious freedom and freedom of conscience. Indications so far show us that the introduction of same-sex marriage in Australia would not allow for conscientious objection from bakers, florists, photographers, and others who provide wedding services. Our Human Rights Commissioner, Tim Wilson, has proposed a regime where a wedding service provider might opt out of civil ceremonies to avoid having to be involved in any same-sex weddings. But civil weddings currently comprise 73% of all marriages in Australia. So if a service provider wanted to avoid providing services for same-sex marriages, they would have to exclude themselves from three-quarters of their target demographic, which would provide a severe financial penalty to them for anyone who chose to do so. It's not exactly a free exercise of conscience. And what about our ability to teach the faith or even to have gatherings like this? A complaint's been made to the Tasmanian Anti-Discrimination Commission against the Australian Catholic Bishops' Conference and Archbishop Julian Porteous for distributing the Don't Mess With Marriage booklet that Bernard was talking about earlier. If successful, there will need to be a re-education program for all Catholic teachers and students in Tasmania and a public apology from the Catholic bishops. If we go back to human rights for a moment, freedom of conscience and religion are recognised as key human rights, and there is no recognised human right to marry a person of the same sex. And I want to be clear about this because a lot of people talk about this as a human rights issue. A case went to the Human Rights Committee, the UN Human Rights Committee, and they said that the human right to marry and found a family does not include a right to marry a person of the same sex. If same-sex marriage is legalised in Australia, the human rights of adults and children look certain to be trampled upon in favour of a non-existent right to same-sex marriage. So it's too simplistic to suggest that a change in marriage law will only affect same-sex couples. Laws shape our culture. They shape the way we think and behave. And while we might not notice the effects immediately, generations to come will definitely be impacted by the decisions we make today. That's all I've got. Actually, while Bernard's coming up, I'm just going to do a shameless plug for our new website. It's called marriageequals.org.au. We've got some fact sheets at the back there. What we're trying to do is just provide you with all of the resources that you need to have conversations like this. We've got fact sheets, we've got infographics, memes, things that are shareable on social media, shareable in universities, schools and things like that. Just trying to bring it to a language where you can have this conversation because it really is up to us. And this talk will be on there, marriageequals.org.au. Oh, it's not Q&A.
Thanks, Monica. That's really such a simple thing we can do. I'm sure Marriage Equals on Facebook. I've seen it there. You can like it, you can share it. It's all shareable. And as people who live on social media, you know, that's our easy domain. That's where we really have to be at the forefront of these things. We'll move quickly to Father Dan. Father Dan McCann has been ordained since 2013, just over 2 years. He is the assistant priest in the parish of St. Charles Borromeo in Ryde. He completed his studies overseas, and he recently completed his licentiate on the psychological and pastoral care of people with same-sex attraction. So he was the very obvious choice to be on our panel. So welcome, Father Dan.
Thank you, Bernard. As I was telling some people before, I am actually the third wheel tonight, after James and Monica. I didn't come with a bunch of PowerPoints, because I really, really wanted to listen to what Monica and James had to say first before I ventured out to speak. Having done this, my thesis in Rome on the pastoral and psychological care of people with same-sex attraction, I was put in touch with James, and we had some international phone conversations in the preparation process. I've now actually met him for the first time tonight. So he was a big source of help for my thesis. So it's been wonderful to meet you and listen to you. Having been a priest for a couple of years and having now started to rack up quite a few hours in the confessional, you realise that the pastoral challenges of dealing with people struggling with same-sex attraction is one that requires a lot of tenderness. It is one that requires a huge amount of patience and constant, constant, ongoing love. My parish priest said something to me when I first moved into the parish, and it's the truest words he's ever said. Pastoral care, and especially in this area of dealing with people with same-sex attraction, is a marathon, not a sprint. We cannot hope to solve or cure anyone overnight. And this actually gives rise to a very important truth. If it was easy to change the way someone loves or wants to love, if it really was just a matter of a couple of talks, a pat on the back, a bit of encouragement, a couple of little things to do, it would actually fly in the face of the dignity of what it means to be a human being. The very fact that it is such an effort, it is nothing short of the cross on Calvary for people to try and live their sexuality authentically and in a way in line with the way God's created them, rather than the way they feel that their body is telling them to. The fact that that costs blood, the fact that that costs so much, points to the very treasure, the very dignity they have as an individual created by God and for God, a being, in short, made for love. We as priests are perhaps in a very privileged place when ministering pastorally to people struggling with same-sex attraction. And it comes from the fact that in our being, we're an icon of Christ. Even if we may not be the best blokes on planet Earth, there is a sacramental presence that we're able to bring in our very being. But even further, and this is very important, the witness of celibacy on the part of priests and religious is so relevant today for all manner of reasons, but in particular for this reason, but in particular in this area, because it shows that one does not have to be sexually active to love authentically sexually. That is very, very, very important. That sexual acting out is not the essence of living one's sexuality authentically. All true sexuality comprises the dynamic of a total giving of oneself to another for the purpose of, in some way, shape, or form, giving life from that act of self-donation. The priests and the religious, and those people, and not just the priests and religious, it is very important that there are a stack of single people in the world who live authentically that witness to total self-giving love, even if they do not necessarily have the grace of a sacramental vocation to express that total love. Nevertheless, this total self-giving love of chaste, celibate loving is life-giving and fruitful. But our culture today, which is hypersexualized, wants to reject that notion as being real or possible, or even something worth pursuing. I've had the pleasure and indeed the privilege of getting to know quite a number of people battling with same-sex attraction. And what James, in particular, has been talking about was something that resonated 100% with all my pastoral experience. Before same-sex attraction is a sexual problem, it is much more an emotional one. There are very deep-seated emotional and identity needs that are getting met, or at least attempting to be met, sexually. And that is what is at the heart. For whatever path the genesis of a same-sex attraction takes in the development of a person, and there is no one-size-fits-all, there is no one set path for why a particular person ends up feeling sexually attracted to someone of the same sex. There is nevertheless, from that, from the very beginning, whatever path that genesis takes, at the crucial point, when puberty sets in, when that sexual awakening happens, there is a fundamental crisis in identity, be it masculine or feminine. And that is why they feel the need to meet that through sexually acting out with people of the same sex. So, I realise I'm going to run far too long, as we won't have time. But if I can just summarise with these couple of points. Firstly, you cannot underestimate and you cannot highlight enough the importance of having good, straight friends for people who are dealing with same-sex attraction, in particular with guys. Because if there is one single factor that is as almost as important as perhaps not bonding properly with one's father, it is peer rejection. Feeling that you are the sissy. Feeling that you are the pretty boy. Feeling that you are the guy that was never good at sport, was never going to man up. Good, strong male friendships are a balm for the man dealing with same-sex attraction. That's very important. Secondly, you cannot highlight enough the importance of including the person's relationship with God into the ultimate healing of their sexuality. When we encounter God in that true personal way that he wants us to encounter him, the whole man or the whole woman wakes up. That includes our sexuality. So there will be a combination between perhaps some psychological help, which is a very, very big no-no to say these days that psychological help is necessary for someone dealing with same-sex attraction. Psychological help in conjunction with good, strong spiritual direction, development of an active prayer life, and the ability to mortify oneself in lots of little things in ordinary everyday life are keys to freeing the heart to eventually discovering how to love and give itself authentically. Thank you.
That was James Parker, Monica Duman, and Father Daniel McCann with What's the Issue with Same-Sex Marriage? This panel discussion took place at Catholicism 101, hosted by Catholic Youth Services in the Archdiocese of Sydney. And for more talks, interviews, and shows, visit cradio.org.au.